In the ancient past, over a period of many years, waves of people migrated south through Asia in search of a new home. At the eastern end of the Malay archipelago, they encountered New Guinea, a rugged tropical island, the second largest in the world. The footnote reads, "Greenland is the largest island in the world. Australia is considered to be a continent, not an island." End of footnote. They trekked along its steamy coastline, settling its vast swamps, dense jungles, and scattered outer islands. Some scaled its mountainous spine to populate temperate highlands blessed with broad valleys and fertile soils. The population formed no unified national group, but was composed of over 1,000 small and often warring tribes. They followed diverse customs, wore distinctive dress, and spoke over 800 languages. Most groups lived in fiercely defended enclaves, completely oblivious to the outside world. Many believed that the horizon hid a realm of demons and departed ancestors who affected their lives for evil or good. People's lives revolved around appeasing those spirits. The population was also physically diverse, barring one widespread characteristic. Noting this feature, Jorge de Meneses, a Portuguese official visiting there in 1526, dubbed the island Ilhas dos Papuas, meaning Land of the Fuzzy-Haired People. The Spanish navigator Inigo Ortiz de Retes felt that the islanders resembled the inhabitants of Guinea, West Africa, so he named the island Nueva Guinea, or New Guinea. In the 19th century, European powers divided the island into three sections. The Dutch, who came first, claimed the western half, which is today part of Indonesia. The British and the Germans divided the eastern half into British New Guinea in the south, later called Papua, and German New Guinea in the north, later New Guinea. After World War I, both of these territories came under Australian control. Finally, in 1975, Papua and New Guinea combined to form the independent nation of Papua New Guinea. The footnote reads, "Throughout this account, we will use the present name Papua New Guinea rather than the earlier terms." End of footnote. Today, Papua New Guinea is still emerging into the modern world. Some of its citizens live in modern cities surrounded by high-tech conveniences. Yet, 4 out of 5 people live in small bush villages, where life has changed little over hundreds of years, and ownership of pigs signifies wealth. Bride price is common, spiritism is widespread, and clan loyalties are paramount. In recent decades, however, this country of contrasts has seen a more significant transformation, one touching sincere people from all ethnic groups and improving their lives in countless ways. It is a spiritual transformation resulting from the study and application of the truths found in God's Word, the Bible. Early bearers of good news. Bible truth arrived in Papua New Guinea in 1932 when a British pioneer named Peck stopped over on his way to Malaya, now Malaysia. Not one to waste an opportunity, Peck spent several weeks preaching to the locals. He placed hundreds of pieces of Bible literature before moving on to his assignment. 3 years later, 7 pioneers aboard the motorized Ketch Lightbearer landed at Port Moresby to repair their damaged engine. During their month-long stay, they zealously preached throughout Port Moresby and nearby areas. One of them, Frank Dewar, a hardy New Zealander, walked inland with a load of books and placed Bible literature with settlers as far as 30 miles from the coast. Some of that literature found its way into the hands of Heni Niaki, a witch doctor from the Koyari tribe. After that, the Bible truths he learned lay dormant in his heart, waiting for Jehovah's Witnesses to return and water what had been planted. During the late 1930s, another pioneer engaged in an extended preaching tour that covered the main towns in Papua New Guinea, including the islands of New Britain, New Ireland, and Bougainville. He placed much Bible literature. But before others could build on his efforts, the region sank into the chaos of World War II. Preaching in the Big Village. 12 years later, On September 22, 1951, a tall Australian stepped out of a plane into Port Moresby's oppressive heat and humidity. Tom Kiddo, a 47-year-old witness, had responded to a call for volunteers to open up the kingdom work in the Pacific Islands. His wife, Rowena, joined him 6 weeks later. Their territory was all of Papua New Guinea. The Kiddos soon discovered that most Europeans in Port Moresby were indifferent to the kingdom message. But then they met Jeff Becknell, a fellow Australian who had drifted away from the truth as a young man. Jeff agreed to study and later became a faithful witness, as did his wife Irene. Tom and Rowena then moved on to Hanuabada, a name meaning big village in Motu, the local language. Extending over Port Moresby Harbor, the village included hundreds of stilt houses connected together by long wooden walkways reaching out from the beach. "People flocked around us to hear the good news," writes Rowena. "There was so much interest that we returned every evening to conduct Bible studies, missing only 2 evenings in 2 months." Tom adds, "The hope of the resurrection and life on a paradise earth really appealed to these people. When Christendom's missionaries and a local policeman pressured them to stop their studies, every one of them stood firm. The truth had settled deep in their hearts." Among those who took their stand for the truth were Raho and Kanio Rekitani, Ada Siani, Gewa Niaki, and her husband, Henny Henny, who had obtained literature from the crew of the Lightbearer 16 years earlier. Soon, a group of about 30 interested ones was coming to Henny Henny's home for regular meetings. "Men and women sat apart on separate sides of the room," recalls Ada Siani, a young boy at the time. "The women wore grass skirts and no tops and carried their babies in colorful string bags that they suspended from the rafters in the room. After breastfeeding their infants, they placed them in the bags and gently rocked them to sleep." Tom Kiddo conducted those meetings with the aid of an interpreter. Understandably, things did not always run smoothly. At one meeting, Henny Henny's brother, Budu Henny, served as interpreter, relates Don Fielder, who arrived in 1953. "Things seemed to be going well at first, with Budu interpreting Tom's words and even copying his gestures. Only later did Budu confess that he did not understand a thing Tom was saying. He just repeated what truths he knew and copied Tom's gestures so that the talk looked right." Despite those challenges, the group grew rapidly, and soon a second group was formed at Raho Rekitani's home, also in Hanuabada village. The following is from pages 83 and 84 of the printed edition. "I conquered my shyness." Ada Siani, born 1939. Baptized 1956. Profile: the first local pioneer in Papua New Guinea. He now serves as a special pioneer in Hohola Matu Congregation, Port Moresby.
"When my older sister saw Tom and Rowena Kiddo preaching along the wooden walkways of Hanuabada village, she asked me to attend their meetings to find out about this new religion. At the time, the meetings were held at the home of Henny Henny Niaki, a local Bible student. I was 13 years old and very shy. I went to Henny Henny's home, where about 40 villagers had gathered, and sat quietly in the background with my head in my hands. I liked what I heard and kept going back. Soon, Henny Henny asked me to interpret Tom Kiddo's English into Motu, the language spoken by most of those present. Some years later, when I began working at a local hospital with the goal of training to be a doctor, John Cutforth took me aside and kindly reasoned with me, saying, 'If you become a medical doctor, you can help people physically. But if you become a spiritual doctor, you can help them gain everlasting life.' That week, I started pioneering. My first assignment was war. I had recently visited the town and had found several persons interested in the truth. One man, Jack Arafai, invited me to preach at the local Lutheran church. I chose God's law and blood as my subject. The 600 people in the congregation paid rapt attention, since many of them believed that eating a person's blood could allow his spirit to take over their body, The priest was furious and told the assembly that they should have nothing to do with me. But many liked what they heard and made further spiritual progress. About a year later, I was assigned to Manu Manu, about 30 miles northwest of Port Moresby. There, I met a local chief, Tom Surau, who invited me to preach in his village. After I had studied with the villagers for 3 days, they chopped up their wooden idol of the Virgin Mary and threw it in the river. People living downstream collected the debris and took it to the Catholic priests in their village, crying out, "They have killed Mary!" Two priests came to confront me. One of them walked straight up to me and punched me in the face, slashing my cheek with his ring. When the local villagers rushed to defend me, the priests ran off. I traveled to Port Moresby to have the cut stitched and to file a complaint with the police. The priests were later fined and defrocked. Meanwhile, I returned to the village and established an isolated group. With Jehovah's help, I had conquered my shyness. Returning to the account.